Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. Happy New Year, Ben.
Happy New Year. I don't know why, but it feels like it's been a really long time since we've done this.
I think it has been. I think it's been a couple weeks.
Man.
But to the viewer, that passage of time is imperceptible.
Yeah. We're recording this in November. We're way, way, way ahead.
Yeah.
We're anticipating a very busy start to the new year. You know, we're coming right up on the launch of Friendly Fire. Our new show with John Roderick, so...
It's true.
That's really exciting.
We also have our very exciting live show at San Francisco Sketchfest.
Yeah. I mean, I'm betting that tickets are sold out by now, but we have no way of knowing that.
That is an optimistic prediction, but it would be a correct prediction given the track record we've had with live shows.
Yeah, so if you go on bit.ly/ggffsketchfest and you see some tickets available, snatch them up. Not gonna want to miss it. It's gonna be a really fun show.
This is gotta tell you, like, this venue, Ben, has a balcony. Did you see that?
Yeah,
we have a fun track record at shows with balconies.
Like, yeah,
this is a statistic that I'm keeping track of.
Yeah,
we've had people making out in balconies.
Mm-hmm.
We've had an attempted scarf throw up into a balcony.
Yeah,
that I don't believe succeeded. It was too far away.
We are nerds with no athletic ability to speak of. So
nerds with blown out rotator cuffs.
How did you blow that out, Adam?
Our first back to back double bill podcast was done at a venue with a balcony. That was our one in Chicago, right?
Yeah, and this is kind of like that, because we're going to do our Greatest Gen show, and then we're going to, like, run backstage for 5 minutes and then come right back out and do a second show of Friendly Fire. And it's going to be intense.
You remember when we got off stage after the Chicago show's second show, and we were like, let us never do two in one night again. We promised each other, Ben.
That was a challenge. And then Roderick was like, hey, do you guys want to do a doubleheader? We're like, yes.
I was like, yeah, as long as you do all the work. And here we are.
Yeah.
The theme of that night is going to be pacing ourselves.
Yeah.
I don't know if my bladder could stand two straight hours on stage. I'm really glad we're going to have that mini intermission.
I was thinking about investing in a stadium pal for that show.
Sure. I mean, I thought you were going to go straight for astronaut diaper. Stadium pal seems like the sort of thing that would make a lot of noise that would be read on the mic.
I thought it would just be like, I would be mid-sentence and then I'd be...
Of course I peed my pants! Everybody my age pees their pants. It's the coolest.
Yeah, I mean, I guess even without the sound of you making water, you yourself would give it away with your extreme sense of joy and relief.
Losing my train of thought because I have to focus on something much more important.
Well, remains to be seen how both our bladders and livers will live up to the challenge of that.
Yeah,
sketch
nobody has
show.
Ever attempted to sell tickets to a live podcast by threatening to maybe pee on stage.
I think Gallagher probably did that, right?
Yeah. Did he have a pod?
He'd fill up a gallon sized Ziploc bag with his urine and then smash it with a giant hammer.
The first four rows will get wet.
Ben, I was at Disneyland last week, and one of the signs on the rides that I went on said, you will get wet, you may get soaked. That's that seems to me like a Greatest Gen promise.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a commitment we can make to anybody, no matter where they're sitting in the house. You will get wet, you may get soaked.
Well, I think one of the signposts that you might see before watching the episode we're going to review, Ben, might be you might get bored, you will get sleepy.
Oh, Adam. This is like people are turning on us because of shit like this.
People really are. Someone, I don't know if it was on Twitter or somewhere else, was like, boy, you can just hear Adam's resignation in every intro and outro to the show. I'm like, that's not resignation, man. That is not resignation at all. That's me trying to come up with a fun button. I've got button duty on this show now after you gave it to me after TNG finished. And my openings are just as punchy as ever, I think.
Well, just to provide some clarity and some contrast, I'll say that I think this may be the first great episode of Deep Space Nine.
Well, I'm ready to argue that point with you, Ben. I'm going to argue a lot of points about Season 1, Episode 12, Battle Lines.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
So the cold open here is Dax and O'Brien have found some files encrypted in the command computer or something. And one of them is like a dossier on Major Kira that was kept by the previous occupant of Sisko's office, Gul Dukat. And they let her read it. And Nana Visitor has, you know, a fun little character turn where she's like, oh, I don't care what those assholes wrote about me.
I'm a big girl, Commander.
And then she like storms out of the office a second later and is very insulted that they did not rate her as being much of a threat to them.
A minor operative whose activities are limited to running errands for the terrorist leaders?
Major.
I was super disappointed that they didn't punch into the obvious Kira Nerys glamour shot that they had in the file.
Yeah.
Like, that was a full-on mall photograph of her.
Yeah.
Do you think they have a glamour shots on the promenade? I bet they do.
Like if you go to the dry cleaners on the promenade, they have headshots of all the command staff.
Well, I was thinking like in a strip mall, you'd get the glamour shots store where you'd go in and you'd like wear a feather boa and they'd shoot you through like four promist filters, and that's the picture that would be on your husband or wife's desk at work.
Yeah, I guess so. It's depressing to see how far laptops are scheduled to backslide in the 24th century. Because I'm sitting here recording my side of this show on a laptop that's like substantially less than an inch thick with like a super high res, bright, beautiful color display. Cisco's got like a 9-inch screen on a 3-inch thick piece of shit.
Dude, you're getting a Dell.
I wonder if eyesight has gotten so much better in the 24th century that it means Sisko doesn't need to lean into his screen like he clearly would have to if he had modern eyesight. Like, he's totally leaned back in his desk chair in a way that would make what he's looking at on screen completely illegible to you and me.
Eagle-eyed Sisko doesn't need to lean in.
Yeah.
This is all just some fun and games that is quickly derailed by the announcement that Kai Upaka has made a unannounced and apparently unaccompanied visit to Space Station Deep Space Nine. She has just like popped up, like the doctor was like digging out some medical supplies from a shuttle, and she just like hops out and is like, hey, I'm here. Tell Sisko. Wanna hang.
She's the most important person on Bajor, and yet, like, to be totally unaccompanied, she's never left Bajor, which was a bit of trivia about her that I found surprising.
Yeah.
She somehow escaped the protection of her secret service, which you know she has. She has no valets with her. She has no dick valets, Ben.
Have you ever seen those documentaries that Oliver Stone made about Fidel Castro?
No.
There's two of them, and they're really weird because it's just Oliver Stone kind of in conversation with Castro in Cuba, and they're subtitled, but there's also an interpreter there, like translating for Castro, so you get the English two ways, and it doesn't always agree.
Fine.
Very distracting films, but I was struck by a sequence in one of them where Oliver Stone and Castro are just like walking around in the streets of Havana, like greeting people and like talking to people. And, you know, George Bush was president when I saw this film, and it was very like striking. Like, you know, George Bush cannot possibly just walk around on a street outside somewhere.
Well, sure. It's because he couldn't read street signs.
Sure. Right. But, you know, like Castro's safety was so ensured in Havana that he didn't feel like worried about like walking around outside, you know?
This was before that one video that surfaced of him falling off stage, right?
But I just thought it was like interesting, the idea that essentially the Pope of Bajor, yeah, like has this kind of, is like brimming with this kind of confidence. Like the Bajorans are like not a homogenous group of people that all agree on what's good for Bajor, you know, like, but she is like, they do all agree that Kaio Paka is great.
Even though she looks like a Shriner Pope.
Shriner Pope, who's just off work from her job at the Ren Fair.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, you know where you can find Oliver Stone films at the video store?
Where, Adam?
Back and to the left.
Oh, no.
Tickets still on sale for San Francisco Sketchfest. A full 2 weeks of the best in comedy.
Yeah.
Featuring yours truly, Adam Pranica.
Amazing that a comedy festival would even allow us to be associated with them.
I'm pretty sure that joke unwound the offer that they extended to us.
Yeah,
show's canceled, look, guys.
If you look in the contract, there's some specific language forbidding that kind of thing.
That's his becoming speech.
You're the captain, sir. You're entitled.
Not entitled to ramble on about something everyone knows.
So Opaka is pretty keen to get a load of the wormhole, and they're like, oh, well, that's too bad. Like, we'd show you out the window here, but there's not really any ships scheduled to go through it today, so there's nothing to see. And there's kind of like a couple of beats of uncomfortable silence, and then Sisko looks around and he's like,
prepare the Yangtze Kion for launch, Chief. Kira and I are taking the Kai through the wormhole.
Road trip!
They're like, get the runabout with the ragtop. Get the thing gassed up.
Yeah.
Let's get this thing going. O'Brien doesn't go on this trip, but he sort of like readies the Winnebago for their journey. and he sort of runs into Opaka outside the door. And Opaka like stares deeply into his eyes and she's like, you have a tremendous pain in your soul, don't you? Takes off her necklace and gives it to O'Brien to give to his daughter, not really having the heart to tell him that soon he'll only be seeing her like every second Tuesday.
I mean, like, this is yet another moment in this show that is just like an RPG where there's kind of a talismanic object given by one character to another. And I'll be interested to see if they pay that necklace gag off. I mean, you know, it's not like she just picked that up at the Claire's on the promenade on her way there. That thing's important.
Give your daughter this appointment for her first ear piercing at Deep Space Claire's. It's just, it's Rom with, like, the ear-piercing gun.
Every Ferengi watches the ear get pierced and just cringes. Yeah. Oh!
They, like, instinctively cross their legs.
Yeah. Oh, man. I never thought about that. Getting your ears pierced for a Ferengi must just be the worst thing in the whole wide world.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen that. No pierced-eared Ferengis.
But the Kai is seeming a little like distant, a little withdrawn. Somebody says that she seems really preoccupied, and
you'd think they'd set her up with like a Pope Mobile runabout, right?
Yeah, a lot
with
more
the glass enclosure.
Yeah, it's just the regular one, and you know, like she thanks them for letting her you know, for indulging her with the road trip. They go through, and they're picking up some like distress signals the second they get to the other side of the wormhole, and they're like, "Well, we should like drop a probe and head home." And she's like, "Well, don't do that on my account. Like, I came for an adventure, guys. Like, let's go see. Let me watch you Starfleets in action."
Like in a horror movie, this is the scene where they drive past a hitchhiker, and yeah, the two people in the front seat are like, "Well, it's a good thing we don't pick up hitchers." And the new person in the back is like, "Well, maybe they just need a ride to the next town. It'd be fun to have someone else to talk to."
Yeah.
Smash cut to extremely scary person sitting in the back seat with everyone.
Mm-hmm. They head toward this planet. And they're picking up like a network of satellites in orbit, which would indicate some sort of civilization down on the surface below. But the scanners don't work that good. And one of the satellites comes out and meets them and is sufficiently powerful that it knocks the runabout out of the sky. And they do a classic Star Trek plummeting through the clouds, cut to black, crash sound effect.
Brace for impact.
All this show is willing to show you are the bangers being dropped on the runabout. It never shows the process of the crash land.
Yeah,
too expensive, Ben.
This is an episode that at one point shows the process of one of the satellites taking out a Starfleet probe by just showing it represented by like Nintendo NES level graphics on a screen.
God, I know. Like, these probes are, you could argue, the most important things in this episode. We never see one.
Yeah.
Opaka, during the crash landing, is loving it. Every once in a while, they cut back to her, and she's, like, smiling with the confidence of someone who's, like, enjoying an amusement park ride. Like,
yeah,
sort of enjoying the terror of it, but knowing that at the end, like, the bar's going to come up, and she's going to go get an elephant ear or something.
Yeah, she's, like, licking her lips. She's like, "Oh, man, should I make a funny face for the part where they take a picture of you?" Her enjoyment does not last long. They blow the explosive bolts on the escape hatch of the runabout and scramble out onto Planet Anybody Canyon. And the Kai is, like, just clinging to life. And Bashir attempts to do some chest compressions and she shuffles loose this mortal coil.
I'm sorry.
What you say? That you only meant well, of course you did.
Ben, I'm no medical professional, but Bashir mentions that she has fractured her cervical spine. And I gotta say, I don't think chest compressions are a good idea with a patient who's injured in that way.
Yeah, I do. How similar are Bajorans on the inside to peoples?
Well, I don't know. Like,
because we know that like Klingons have like multiple hearts, right? Like, you can't stab a Klingon in the heart and have that kill them.
The ground doesn't look very soft if you're just going to press on an old lady's chest who has also broken their back.
Yeah.
I think you gotta, like, why doesn't the runabout have the kit that you find in a shopping mall today? Like that you put the patches on the heart attack victim's chest and then the box just sort of does the work. They need a box that does the work because Bashir, with only a tricorder, like, they didn't pack for this trip well at all, Ben.
No, and
like, they're going on a road trip with an old, and they didn't bother to bring any like heart medication or whatever.
And Bashir's talked a lot of shit about how Deep Space Nine is his opportunity to make a hero of himself because of all the frontier medicine he'll be doing. Like, come on, man, tricorder is not gonna cut it.
Yeah, this is like, this tantamount to like slapping Kai Opaka around with a wagon wheel. Like, he doesn't have the tools or the knowledge to save her.
Yeah.
We witness another death in this scene, Ben. RSVP Yangtze Kang.
Yeah. But the Kai's death is an opportunity for Nana Visitor to do some like real big grief acting. And this really gave me goosebumps. I think she did a great job with this scene because she's kind of doing death rites. You know, like she's saying some prayer in, I guess, the Bajoran language as she, you know, as she deals with the pain of losing this important spiritual figure in her life. And it's like, I don't know, like Sisko and Bashir are like, whoa, you know, like it does not mean the same thing to them, but it doesn't really matter to Kira. Like she really throws herself into this.
I was also thinking that Alexander Siddig and Avery Brooks were also looking at each other in this scene, like, whoa. Because, like, Nana Visitor here is willing to ugly cry. And as great as she is in this scene, like, she really gives TV acting more than TV acting asks of her.
Yeah.
In this scene and in many others, you know? Like, she's really willing to go there in a great way that really, really makes you sit up, I think.
Yeah. She's dedicated to this character in a way that, like, if you think back to, like, early TNG seasons, especially season one, I feel like, to a certain extent, everybody in the main cast is like, all right, when is this going to be over? Like, is pilot season coming up? Like, I want to try out for a real show.
What was the greatest amount of emotion shown on TNG? I'm struggling to come up with an example that goes as far as Kira does in this moment.
Yeah. I mean,
like, even when Tasha Yar died, no one cried, to my knowledge.
No, they had a stunned silence, I think.
When Riker's driving the ship through Wolf 359, no one's crying then.
No.
Mostly people were pissed at Admiral Halsey, I get that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe Admiral Halsey like went to the bathroom and looked at himself in the mirror and was like, "Fuck, fuck."
Yeah, I am so ill-equipped for this moment.
Fuck! Oh God. Well, there.
Can you imagine the panic shit that Halsey took before Wolf 359? Like it was total evacuation, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord, like. I've taken some panic shits before our live shows before that felt fairly gripping,
yeah.
But nothing that's Halsey level.
No, no. Yeah. Even you can't rise to Halsey level panic shit.
Thank you, Ben.
Kira is having this moment, and it kind of gets interrupted because low rent Mickey Rourke and his buddies come out of a cave nearby, and we get to know these guys. These guys are members of a group called the Ennis, and the Ennis are some bad mamajamas that are really surprised to have any kind of strangers on their planet, and they're also pretty surprised that the that these strangers don't know anything about them. You know, like there's some kind of, like, so you don't know anything about the punishment?
If you haven't realized we're at war.
All right, well, that's interesting. Anyways, we'll protect you from our hated enemies, the Nol Ennis.
A brutal enemy that attacks at whim.
You know, Sisko is like, hey man, like, you know, we got to stay out of that kind of shit. Like, we're not really interested in that. We're waiting for our rescue party. They'll be along shortly, but you know, we got a doctor with us, and he'll look at that weird patch of flesh on your forehead if you need.
Silence of the land.
The leader, the Ennis, is played by Jonathan Banks. Ben, sort of a that guy of through the years, most notably from Breaking Bad. He's Mike Ehrmantraut.
I'm not a fan of Breaking Bad, so I didn't recognize him from that.
To me, I thought they made him up. Like, if you're just sort of spitballing what the makeup and costuming is going to be for Golan Shelah, I think you probably hold up a picture of Khan just before he sets off the Genesis device on the Reliant. Like, he's totally lazy-eyed, and his hair's kind of on fire, and, like, half of his scalp was peeled back.
Yeah, his hair is nicely on fire in this episode, I will say.
Little more of a hair part than you want.
Yeah.
If you're styling your own hair, I think.
Yeah, you gotta like,
very severe part.
Use a little less of a wrist twist when you're parting your hair, because that is it's doing some damage.
sometimes you don't want to cut the comb through your own hair. You want to use your fingers to do the part.
Yeah.
A little bit of a messy part can look nice.
Right. It looks a little, you know, a little sprezzatura, a little dashing unevenness.
You might take some notes from Dr. Bashir. he's got a dashing disheveledness to him.
Yeah. So Bashir starts doing some, you know, some laying on of hands, trying to help out these people, and sort of like mid conversation, the Noel Ennis attack. And it's like, it's another one of these Deep Space Nine gunfights where like nobody is behind cover and everybody's just kind of shooting willy-nilly, and I was like, oh, come on, guys. And then the reason for this fight being this way is actually revealed. Like, Kira is like, what the fuck is wrong with you guys? You don't have any strategy for, like, guarding your territory. You don't have systems in place for, like, alerting people, like, deeper in the caves that the people at the front of the cave are getting attacked. Like, what is your problem?
You're not trying to hide from each other? Like it's fucking laser tag or something?
Yeah, like they get through this battle and the only people left standing are Kira, Bashir, and Sisko. Like, literally everybody else is dead or dying. And they're, like, standing around. Bashir is, like, a chicken with his head cut off, trying to decide who to treat first. And they look up, and into the cave walks the previously dead Kaio Paka.
Throughout Star Trek, I feel like there's a real... there's a real lack of people acting surprised when it's appropriate to be surprised. They're looking at zombie Kaio Paka, and no one goes, holy shit! or like, killer! Kill zombie Opaka! like, there's never that moment, and I feel like that would be totally grounded in reality. Like, it's okay to act crazy when something crazy happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a moment of awe. And
sure.
Like, maybe the most awed person in the scene is Opaka. Like, she walks in, like, wide-eyed and, like, almost jaw-dropped. Doesn't make a lot of sense to her.
She turns to Bashir and she's like, I don't know what you were thinking back there with those chest compressions. Extremely painful, doctor.
They're like, Kai, what do you remember about what happened? She's like, okay, well, we came out of the sky, we crashed, and then you guys pulled me out, and then I was like trying to breathe, but this asshole just kept slamming his hands into my chest. And
did you know my body was on top of a couple of rocks? A moment later, all the other dead people start waking up too, Ben.
Yeah.
Also to medium surprise by everyone.
Yeah. And so what we learn is that the punishment that this guy had alluded to is that they have eternal life and they're kind of doomed to just fight this war with each other forever. And anytime they die, they come back alive, which is why they don't, you know, care that much about strategy or tactics in their war, because none of it really matters.
And so the idea of like living forever, being punished forever,
yeah,
is a special sort of awful.
It's an insanely bleak idea for Star Trek, and I mean it sort of confounds reason. But I think that there's like sectarian violence all over the world that's sort of like this, where it's just like, guys, like, this is something that your great grandparents were pissed off at each other over. Can we just like drop the thing? But it's like, you know, somehow you can't. And like,
it's the worst punishment.
Yeah.
It is. It's
like they can't die,
hell.
But they also can't really win. Like there's no resolution because all they can do is like make each other more and more miserable.
I wish we got the Groundhog Day montage of all the ways in which they tried to get out of this arrangement.
Yeah.
Well, drowning didn't work and neither did fire. Jonathan Banks tried to cut his own hair with an axe and that's why he looks that way.
Yeah.
I thought they would have been more scarred for a people that have lived for hundreds of years being unable to die.
I wonder if they looked like this when they got there, you know? Like, they were already scarred from their war on their other planet. They come from a planet where they were, like, engaged in a sectarian conflict for generations and generations, and it sounds like the kind of, like, world government, some body that was above the level of this conflict, just kind of, like, solved the problem of these two groups of people hating each other by shipping them all to this moon and making an example out of them. Like, if you guys can't resolve your problems nicely, this is what will happen.
So Bashir figures out that that people on this planet are filled with a form of nanite that sort of, like, resurrects them on a cellular level.
Yeah.
That's the reason they keep dying and waking back up again.
Got to get some of those nanites.
It seems like one of the things that's never mentioned is, like, how this power seems like something that may be able to be leveraged, but no one ever considers that, right? Like, it's a form of punishment and punishment only.
Right.
But it sure seems like if you could save someone's life in a constructive way, this might be worth researching.
Well, and it's also a punishment that only works if they keep being brutal to each other, you know? Like, the hardness of it kind of is couched in their mutual hatred.
Yeah, they've never tried diplomacy, I guess.
Yeah.
Diplomacy's for quitters.
Yeah. So meanwhile, Dax and O'Brien have piled into one of the other runabouts and headed through the wormhole to look for them. Because the government back on Bajor is basically flipping out. They're like, so our spiritual leader apparently got in a Winnebago with, like, a handful of people from your space station and went to the opposite side of the galaxy. And we haven't heard from her, and we're really fucking worried.
I wish we saw the FaceTime of the panicked security officer in Kaiopaka's room with the Ferris Bueller dummy sitting up in its bed and the snore machine on. Like,
yeah.
We've been duped!
Like, I feel like this would have been an interesting opportunity to do a little exposition about where Bajor is at in terms of, like, capabilities. Like, do they have ships? Is the military organization that Kira is a part of equipped enough to, like, put a hard target search together? Because it seems like this would be something that they would want to devote some resources to, but they kind of cruise past that. And it's up to Miles and Dax in a runabout to solve this problem. So they head through the wormhole and they find the, like, warp trail, and they're, you know, searching the system where the Yangtze Kien went missing, and they find this moon that everything's taking place on. But O'Brien realizes that the network of satellites is something that they've got to be pretty worried about, because since the last runabout went down, they have to assume that something in orbit of this planet is shooting down planes.
O'Brien's really the hero of this episode. He pulls up without a satellite shooting down his runabout. He's the one that's tasked with figuring out how to penetrate this shield of satellites.
I feel like this is, like, TNG style problem solving. Like he's kind of, like, pulling out the Data and Geordi playbook and coming up with a cool technological solution on the fly.
Sisko the entire time is filled with the confidence of someone who believes in his heart that O'Brien and Dax will save his ass.
Our rescue is not going to take years. Days, weeks, maybe. But they will find us. And then they'll penetrate the defense net and transport us out of here.
Yeah. He's, like, making promises based on the premise that Dax and O'Brien, who he has not yet talked to, will be there soon enough. He's like,
we'd be willing to transport all of you away from here if that's what you want.
Listen, everybody, I know that you're fighting. I know that you've been fighting for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, for as long as any of you can remember. But what I propose is that we take you all away from this place. We can, you know, put the Ennis on one planet and the Null Ennis on another. You guys can live out the rest of your natural lives and then die normally and stop, you know, this horrible, bleak ass shit that you guys have been up to for all this time.
I don't expect you to understand this, but no one is as motivated as someone who's in the midst of marital estrangement. And the man up there in that runabout works the longest hours of anyone on the station. It's because he doesn't want to go home. If anyone could save us, it's Miles O'Brien. Trust me on this.
The Ennis and the Noel Ennis are like, listen, man, like, you seem pretty cool. I think it's cool that you flipped that chair around and sat on it backwards and everything, but we don't really know you, so how can we trust you? And especially the Noel Ennis guy, he's like, you've been hanging out with these Ennis asswipes for days. Like, how do I know that this isn't just a trick for them to draw all my people out into the open and then, you know, slaughter them painfully?
The Noel Ennis really look like Team Daniel Boone to me. Like Daniel Boone versus the Road Warriors. They've really chosen their sides with costuming here.
It's like Daniel Boone fucked one of the rebels from the beginning of Star Wars.
Sure.
Yeah, so this first attempt at diplomacy by Sisko devolves into them just cutting each other up with knives on sticks. And in the midst of the fight, like, somebody is about to throw a hatchet at Sisko, and Bashir saves Sisko, like, just barely, and is like, hey, man, we can't afford to die here. I just figured out something about science.
No time to explain right now.
You don't really need to justify saving Sisko's life here.
Yeah, it sort of presupposes that Sisko believes he's going to live forever on the planet.
Yeah.
Even though that part, like, he never expresses that idea.
No.
And that should have been something that he asked when Kaio Paka showed up. Like, that would have been my first question. As soon as we see Kaio Paka, I would have turned to the doctor and been like, so can we all live forever on this planet?
Yeah.
I'd want to know that right away.
Don't want to make an assumption like that.
You want to know for sure if you're going to be grandfathered into immortality.
Right. The problem here is that the nanorobots that are making everybody resurrect rely on something about the local ecology of this planet to work. And anybody that has died here, that's taken off the planet, will succumb to the death that they already died. So they can't leave with Opaka, and they're like, oh, shit, like, who's going to tell her? This is going to be a really awkward conversation.
Yeah, and so it's Sisko and not Kira that does.
Well, he's, like, about to, and she's like,
are we staying, Commander?
And they're like, what? And she's like, listen, like, I'm a spiritual person. Like, prophecies have been telling me that this is going to be what I did my entire life. And I think that Opaka's, like, I think that one thing that I never loved about Deep Space Nine was how much it is about religion and faith and spirituality, which are, you know, things that I, you know, at various times in my life have had great reverence for and a total lack of respect for and something in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I don't personally have a major, like, faith aspect to my personality. Like, I like going to high holiday services around the high holidays with my wife, but I don't, like, consider myself Jewish or a Christian or really anything. So, like, it's always been a little bit of, like, a thing that bugged me about the series is that, like, it took Trek, which wasn't ever much about that, and made it a lot about that. But and in Kaio Paka, she says something, like, pretty early on that in the episode, like, this is like me testing a prophecy. Like, prophecies are not always, like, super clear what they mean, so you have to test them, which is not so much religion as it is science. And it made me kind of understand the Bajoran religion in a different way.
Hmm.
And, like, you know, I don't think the Bajoran religion is ever, like, totally fleshed out. But it made me think that maybe it's more of a, like, way for a people to be spiritual and, like, have the kind of, like, community benefits of religion without it having, like a supernatural aspect. Like, they know that the prophets are some external force, but and they choose to talk about them as prophets, but they're not rounding them up to just like some kind of all thing that is, you know, that has an unknowable agenda and can't be like understood from a scientific perspective.
I think my issue with it is similar to your issue with Q, in that creatively, the idea of religion or spirituality resolving story problems feels
right.
super crutchy to me.
Yeah, totally.
And like, so if you're trying to break an episode like this and you get to the end and you're like, well, with a figure like Kai Opaka, let's just have her say that it's part of her predestination and leave it at that. Like, that is a very easy, neat way to resolve this that is a little too much of a gift that the idea of religion can give a character on this show. You know, like, in harder sci-fi, I think it asks you to create more, like create the answer out of science. That's sci-fi.
I would agree with you, except for the way Camille Saviola plays Kai Opaka in the last scene really makes it about like her making an active choice. Like, she's been a religious leader and has like kind of risen to the top of her game, and now she wants like a real challenge kind of thing. And so she's like her reason for staying here on this planet is not I'm going to die if you take me away. It's I want to attempt to build bridges between these two people that hate each other. And when they beam up, they cut to a close up of her face, and it's pretty clear to me, at least, that like the gravity of this choice that she's made is kind of washing over her. Like, she has made a really intense career move here.
Yeah, but what choice did she have? It wasn't a choice. It's die or stay.
Right, but she made the choice before she knew that. That's why I think it's so interesting. I feel like if they came to her and were like, "Hey, listen, like bad news, but we can't leave with you," and she's like, "Oh, well, I guess I can like find some good in this by, you know, devoting myself to building peace between these people," would have been a cornier ending to me.
Yeah, that's true. Still a fair amount of corn.
Yeah.
In the ending of this episode.
She puts Kira in a real awkward position because he's like, "Hey, when you get back to Bajor, tell all of our people that I did that I did this willingly."
Yeah, don't kill the messenger there.
They'll take your word for it. You're Kira.
A minor operative.
There's a lot of like spiritual enabling that Kai Opaka does with Kira. Like, there's a scene where Kira's like going hog wild about like teaching the people how to fight and like, let's get these guys trained up and ready to kill. And Kai Opaka like sort of brings Kira to kneel in front of her and sort of like pulls an epiphany out of her ear the way that like a grandpa pulls a quarter out of a grandchild's ear. And it's never really explained, but it looks like Kai Opaka like has the power of touch.
You got the touch. You got the power
to sort of touch epiphany people. And so Kira just sort of like looks up and is like, "Oh, I finally get it. Like, I understand what my nature is, and I understand why I act the way that I do." And I'm wondering, as someone who doesn't have a lot of experience with Deep Space Nine, like whether or not we see a real pivot in Kira's character after that moment, because it appears that she had a profound epiphany in that scene.
Right, that she's like a creature of violence, and that. You know, she's been in denial about that in the post-war period.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the other interesting theme that the episode explores is like how set in their way the Ennis and the Null Ennis are. Like when Bashir realizes what the nanites are and is like, "Oh, like, well, maybe I can figure out a way to cure them." Like, the Ennis guy, like, the only thing he can think about is, like, "We'll use it on the other guys, and then they'll die, and they'll all be dead, and we'll win." Like, that's the only way he can, like, conceptualize using a medical intervention.
You know what's so fucking weird about that reaction is that, you know, earlier on in the episode, Golan Shelah seems to need the idea of death, like, as a form of peace. Like, oh God, finally, like this, there's this dream of ours that we've had of finally dying. And yeah. When he's given the idea of that, that he immediately perverts it into a weapon is so weird to me.
Right. It's like the greatest gift he could give the bad guys.
Yeah. So what does he really want? Does he want to die or does he want to win the war? Because if he were to win the war, then what? Would he want to die right after and die a winner? I don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, but that's the thing about some of these, like, these conflicts that, like, if you're not in them, it's really hard to empathize with the point of view of the people that are.
Yeah, did you like this episode, Ben?
I really did. Like, I obviously don't think it's a perfect episode, but I thought it had a bunch of really interesting ideas in it and a bunch of great performances. Like, I think for the first time, Bashir is starting to seem, like, humanized and not just, like, there to be a creepy weirdo character. Right. I like the roles that a lot of the characters got. And I like the, like set up some interesting premises and really chewed on them.
I think I like the episode too. I really like what it did to O'Brien. It elevated him out of Chief O'Brien, Deep Space Nine janitor, and turned him into like a competent engineer person.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the utter exclusion of Dax, who really does nothing except ride shotgun in this episode. She does nothing here.
Yeah. And I think, is Quark even in the episode?
No, I don't think so. Not that I can remember. Not memorable, if so.
I thought that the leader of the Noel Ennis might be Neil Breen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about Neil Breen?
Tell me about Neil Breen.
Neil Breen is a guy who, he's kind of like a little bit like the guy that made The Room. He's like a a crazy weirdo that has sort of an unknowable provenance and claims to like be an architect and real estate agent, but is now making like vanity project feature films that he, you know, writes, directs, and stars in.
Sure.
And they've reviewed a couple of his movies on the Flophouse here on MaximumFun.org, and I've only watched one of them, Fateful Findings, but it's like a really fucking unbelievable artifact of, you know, the ramblings of a crazy person. And the leader of the Noel Ennis looks just like him.
But it's not him.
Neil no, did sadly not make it is it not.
All the way to the summit of bit part in DS9.
Well,
didn't that's how you
it.
Know you've made it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Adam, should we check our inbox, see if we have any Priority One messages?
You know you've made a P1 message if we read it, Ben. Let's see what we got in the box.
The only way to find out for sure.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have a couple of Priority One messages here. First is from Austin Harper. Hey, we know Austin.
Yeah, he's the mod of our Facebook group, right?
Yeah, and it is for everybody. And
everybody!
It goes like this. It goes like this. Rez and Plavim both seem like great guys, but the Rascals can go fuck themselves. Hashtag Team Plavim for life. P.S. Everybody is welcome in the Facebook group, whether you're Team Plavim or if you're wrong.
Very good.
Damn. Wow. There's going to be...
We were just wondering where Team Plavim was. Here they are.
Yeah. I feel like there could be a real schism in the Facebook group after this.
Well, when you're on, when you've picked a faction and then aligned yourself with a mod, it's a pretty powerful ally, I think.
Yeah. Doesn't Rascals have their own Facebook organizing committee now?
They do, but I don't know if they've wrangled a mod in with them. Maybe. Maybe that's who the Gooch is.
Oh. Who
Shout knows? Out to the Gooch.
as good a time as any to thank Austin for the great work he does maintaining the Facebook group.
Yeah, no kidding.
We don't
Austin
deserve
Harper
him.
More than a Facebook group janitor, that's yeah. for sure. The Miles O'Brien of our Facebook group. Thanks, Austin. Ben, our second priority one message is from Emily. It is for Andrew. Message goes like this. You're braver than Worf. Wiser than Picard and sexier than Riker. And with a better beard. You're a better cat dad than Data. And the best dad in the galaxy. We're 5 years into our mission and the sky's the limit. You're my best friend and I love you. Happy anniversary. I wish I could write an anniversary card as eloquent as that. That's great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's beautiful sentiment, Emily. You're a lucky dude, Andrew.
Yeah, seriously. Count your lucky stars, dude. Well, if you'd like to send a Priority One message, it's real easy. You go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, and commercial messages are $200, and personal messages are $100, and they are a great way to support the production of The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Drunk Shimoda!
Sure did. It's another one of the timestamp Shimodas.
Oh, yeah.
Ben, those are our favorites. Some of our favorites, I think. If you scrub to 40 minutes and 30 seconds, it's a scene where Kai Opaka has sort of embraced the gravity of her circumstance. She's like, well, maybe it's time for me to be here and counsel these people. And then she says, it is time for these people to begin their healing process. And then they rack focus to a lady behind her. This lady behind her is like, fuck you. I don't need your help. Stay out of our business, lady. That look on her face, I don't know how you direct that out of someone. But like... these people do not need or want Kai Opaka's help. I thought that moment was like just a glaring emotional misfire. It stuck out like a sore thumb to me. So that lady in the background who doesn't want any of her damn help is my drunk Shimoda.
Nice. Well, speaking of people in the background, I'm giving mine to Kai Opaka for her performance in the runabout is going down scene. There's a. I will also give you a timestamp. If you go to 10 minutes and 25 seconds, Sisko is in the foreground and Kai Opaka is in soft focus in the background, kind of praying, but also just licking her chops in anticipation of this crash. gets a big old lick on those lips.
Oh, she does. What is up with that? She's like, num, 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 num.
Yummy crash.
That atmosphere's going to cook us alive. I love the taste of my shattered vertebrae.
Damok Angelad at Tanagra. Damok Angelad at Tanagra.
Ben, what do we have coming up on the next episode?
The next episode is Season 1, Episode 13, The Storyteller. Against his will, O'Brien becomes the spiritual leader of a Bajoran village and the only one that can save them from a destructive energy force.
Oh, goody.
Yeah.
I've long wanted an O'Brien as Christ allegory.
Yeah. I mean... I think it's time.
It's something we've both suspected for a while.
All right. Shall I generate a random number to determine if we are going to be getting housed in this episode?
Ben, briefly describe the rules one more time, if you would.
So the number of we have a one out of the number of episodes in a season chance of drinking for any given episode.
Not episodes remaining in the season. Total number of episodes in a season. I think that's where a lot of people are getting hung up.
Yeah, yeah. We never said that thing about it would be episodes remaining, but somehow that's what got out there. So for the purposes of this season, we're going a 1 in 15 chance. And I am generating the number, and it is a 10. So once again, we will be having a mostly dry episode.
Hashtag never dry.
Adam, before we close this out, this is long, long overdue. Something that was sent in October, and I totally forgot to play it on the show until now. But listener Jake sent in a kind of a mash-em-up song based on the song "The Cisco Kid" by War, where he dropped in a whole bunch of Deep Space Nine sounds, and it's real fun. So we're gonna play that after the credits here on the end of the episode, and stick around for it. It's really fun.
What an inspired combo!
Yeah, good stuff.
Well, if you're inspired by anything we've said on this show, I would encourage you to talk about it on one of our many social media outlets. We've got a Facebook page and a Reddit group, and we're on Twitter, probably more than is healthy these days.
Yeah.
Find us over there using the hashtag GreatestGen. Find a friend over there. We hear all the time about what great places these are to chat and hang out and escape from the nightmare that is daily life.
Yeah, the social media has not been a fun place to be, but for the Greatest Gen community of late. And so we want to appreciate all of you guys for being such a positive force in our lives. And we'll try and be a positive force in your lives as a big thank you for that.
Really appreciate all the support the show gets at MaximumFun.org/donate. We cannot keep doing the show without listener support, and we really appreciate that.
Yeah, we should thank Dark Materia for our theme music and Adam Ragusea for a growing number of song clips that are taking over the Deep Space Nine version of The Greatest Generation in a great, great way. And we'll thank the folks at MaximumFun.org who provide a ton of support for the program as well. So if you need a new podcast in your life, and The Greatest Generation, The Greatest Discovery, and the upcoming Friendly Fire aren't going to fill all the holes in your listening schedule, I would highly recommend checking out some Maximum Fun podcasts. They're great.
Fill all your holes. That's
fill
what
them
Ben's
all.
Saying.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm stepping on your outro.
I got to give it the right energy, Ben.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound like I'm a hostage here. With that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. On an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine that turns the lowly lava lamp into a scary antagonist.
Okay, let's do it!
Captain Benjamin Sisko.
And I couldn't be happier.
Congratulations.
Things got a little tense there for a while. Calm never got me a damn thing. Sisko kid.
what this is all about. You are absolutely right. That's enough.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.